Hi, everyone. We start the hour with the latest in the Trump presidency after a weekend of staff shakeups and new revelations in the Mueller investigation. Here's what we know so far. Special Counsel Robert Mueller and New York prosecutors are compiling at least two separate cases against President Donald Trump and his associates. The Special Counsel Office alleges that Donald Trump pursued a lucrative business deal in Russia as a presidential candidate and did not tell the American public. A separate investigation in the Southern District of New York found that Michael Cohen, Trump's former personal attorney, quote, deceived the voting public. Cohen is accused of violating campaign finance laws by paying hush money to two women who said they had affairs with the president. The prosecutors say Cohen did all of this at the direction of then-candidate Donald Trump. On Saturday, the president seemed to brush it off.
On the Mueller situation, we're very happy with what we are reading because there was no collusion whatsoever. There never has been. The last thing I want is help from Russia on a campaign.
Predictably, the Democrats had a different reaction. Here's Adam Schiff, the incoming chairman of the House Intelligence Committee on CBS.
My takeaway is there's a very real prospect that on the day Donald Trump leaves office, the Justice Department may indict him, that he may be the first president in quite some time to face the real prospect of jail time.
And here's John Dean, the White House counsel under President Nixon, speaking on CNN over the weekend.
I think what today's filings show that the House is going to have little choice the way this is going other than to start impeachment proceedings.
And the news did not end there for the Trump administration. On Saturday, President Trump announced that John Kelly, his chief of staff, will also be leaving by the end of the year. Nick Ayers, the chief of staff to Mike Pence, also announced his departure. Yep, we've got a lot to talk about, and hopefully you've got the time. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Here to make sense of all this is Jessica Roth, a professor at Cardozo Law School and a former federal prosecutor in the Southern District of New York. Jessica, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by Annie Carney, White House correspondent for The New York Times. Hi, Annie.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Jessica, I want to start with you. Let's take a look at the memo we got on Friday night from the Southern District of New York. And I'm quoting here, Cohen sought to influence the election from the shadows and, quote, Cohen deceived the voting public by hiding alleged facts that he believed would have had a substantial effect on the election. Jessica, what do you make of those charges?
Well, what the Southern District is making clear in that filing is that they believe that President Trump is implicated in the campaign finance violation that Michael Cohen has pled guilty to. The filing is quite clear that President Trump directed Michael Cohen to make those payments, or one payment he made directly, another he coordinated with a media organization to make the payment to the women. And each of those two payments constituted a separate violation of the campaign finance laws. So were the president any other person other than the sitting president of the United States, he would be in very serious legal jeopardy at this point.
That legal jeopardy includes, what is this listed as a felony so far? Where I saw that word floating around all weekend. I just want to be sure we're clear.
Absolutely. It's a felony. Each count, each of the two separate campaign finance violation counts is a separate felony. And then there's also the possibility of a charge of conspiracy to violate the campaign finance laws. And that would be a third additional felony.
Also coming from the special counsel's office, want to pivot here for a minute. They're talking about the quote unquote Moscow project. Here's what the president had to say a couple days before the release of those findings.
So he's lying about a project that everybody knew about. I mean, we were very open with it. We were thinking about building a building. I guess we had in a form. It was an option. I don't know what you'd call it. I decided ultimately not to do it. There would have been nothing wrong if I did do it. If I did do it, there would have been nothing wrong. That was my business.
Jessica, there's a lot of I didn't do it, I did do it. What is he talking about doing or not doing in this case?
I believe what he's talking about is whether there actually existed a project that had gotten off the ground or that had legs, if you will, in Moscow for the Trump Organization. What Michael Cohen most recently admitted is that he, on behalf of the Trump Organization, was in communication with people in Russia who had connections to Russian government officials at the highest levels about this prospect of the Trump Organization project, and that those communications continued well through the campaign, long after Mr. Cohen himself told Congress in a filing that they continued, and long after Mr. Trump was telling voters on the campaign trail that he had any possible interests in Moscow. So that's significant on a variety of levels. But if, in fact, the Trump Organization was continuing to pursue business opportunities in Russia during the campaign, that opens up the door to the possibility that they were in communication with Russian officials about some kind of quid pro quo or some coordination that would give Russian officials things that they wanted in exchange for things that the Trump Organization wanted, including business opportunities.
Annie, I want to bring you in here. There's no shortage of news this weekend. We're nearing the end of the year, and President Trump said his chief of staff, John Kelly, will be stepping down. What's the relationship been between Kelly and Trump so far?
It's been just steadily decreasing in the amount of time they spend together and respect they have for each other. John Kelly came in with plans to instill order on a disorderly West Wing, and his credentials as a four-star Marine general gave a lot of people inside of the West Wing hope that things would change. But it has sort of diminished to a stalemate of coexistence between the two men, Kelly and the president, where Kelly essentially takes the approach of let Trump be Trump, because trying to control him is just impossible. So the news that Kelly is leaving has been anticipated for months. What was shocking about what happened over the weekend was that the anticipated replacement, Nick Ayers, who serves as Vice President Pence chief of staff, said he would not take the job. And so that leaves Trump with no clear candidate. He doesn't really have a clear second choice in mind.
And what is that? I mean, we also saw that because of Ayers is not in line for the position, I'm wondering what does that mean for Mike Pence? He doesn't have a chief of staff. So we're chief of staff-less at the highest levels.
We're chief of staff-less. And the Pence drama is obviously less interesting. It's not as important of a job. The chief of staff in the White House is essentially a cabinet-level position. It's the hardest job in Washington. And Pence world is relatively stable. So I don't know yet who will take that job. But the question is, who will replace Kelly? Who wants the job? He has a short list of candidates who are names that have been around before but sort of dropped off, and he's resurfacing now. Some of them are hinting they no longer want it. So what happened over the weekend is Ayers pulling out at the last second. He said that he would do it on an interim basis, but he wouldn't agree to the 2-year time frame that Trump laid out for him. It almost diminished the job in that this 36-year-old political operative is saying no thanks to the most important job in Washington. It shocked a lot of people inside the West Wing. It puts Trump in an awkward position of making it look like he can't find anyone to take this job.
Well, let's be clear. I mean, this administration is not new to turnover, so this is not something that's as surprising. But as you say, at this job, at this level, it's pretty intense. I want to ask you, Jessica, just turning back for a second, when we talk about the president and whether or not he engaged in business dealings with Russia, is the issue that he did not tell the American public? And if he had, would we be in the clear right now?
It's a political issue, what he told the American people or failed to tell the American people. It's not really a criminal law issue. It's not a crime to lie to the United States people on the campaign trail. It is a lie. It is a crime to lie to federal investigators. And so if Trump made statements in those written submissions to Mueller recently submitted, that would constitute a felony. If he coordinated with people in the Russian government who were involved in trying to affect the U.S. election, that could be a criminal conspiracy. If he was in coordination with people who were hacking into Hillary Clinton's emails, that's what could be a criminal conspiracy to violate the statute that makes it a crime to hack into someone's computers. So there are a lot of potential charges that Mueller seems to be investigating. But just the fact of lying to the American people on the campaign trail, that's actually not a crime.
Not a crime. And I think, well, I'll reserve comment on that one. But I do want to know, we talked about this earlier, the special counsel is essentially indicating that the president is involved in some sort of a felony. And I'm wondering, if they are accusing the president of committing a felony, here's the big question on everyone's mind: can the president be indicted? There's a lot of talk about whether or not a sitting president can be indicted. Jessica, help us understand this, please.
that is actually an open legal question. There is no Supreme Court precedent on that question. There is a memo written by an office within the Department of Justice opining that a sitting president cannot be indicted. But as I said, that's an internal memo. It could be reversed by a subsequent memo within the Department of Justice. Most people think that Mueller will abide by that current memo and would not indict a sitting president. Probably the Southern District of New York would abide by the memo as well, but we don't know that for sure. But here's the thing. If President Trump is no longer President Trump after the next election, so if he either doesn't run for election again or he's not reelected, we would still be within the statute of limitations on the campaign finance violations. Those are felonies that carry a five-year statute of limitations. The conduct occurred in mid-2016. So we have up through, prosecutors have up through mid-2021 to file those charges. So he's not in the clear.
It feels like that's coming up sooner than we would like. Annie, can you help us tie all of this together? I mean, with this White House reshuffling, the Mueller investigation, the White House is in chaos yet again. As a White House correspondent, what are you seeing inside? Are people nervously expecting that the president will be indicted? Are they just worried about the short-term cabinet changes? What's the vibe?
The vibe inside is always often oddly focused on the smaller ball issues than the big picture. And I think that this Nick Ayers news that broke last night really shocked people. And he's going into a reelection cycle. He needs someone to work with, try and work with Democrats on any legislation he can get done, drive his campaign, protect him from what's coming from Mueller. And right now, it looks like a ship with no captain.
And is there a sense that are people concerned that the president could be indicted?
Yes, but again, it's funny. Inside, people are more concerned with who's going to take the position of the president's body man, because that position, that's someone who's leaving too. That often these small fights and take up more airtime inside than the big questions of, is the president going to get indicted? I haven't heard anyone suggest that from inside.
Well, we'll sure be paying attention. Annie Carney is a White House correspondent for The New York Times. And Jessica Roth is a professor of law at Cardozo School of Law and a former federal prosecutor. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
The quickest way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
And here's the thing. It was guns, good guys with guns, that saved the day.
Let there be no mistake in what I'm about to say. The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
We've heard it many times. A good guy with a gun can stop a bad guy with a gun. But what happens when the good guy with the gun is black? When gunfire broke out at a shopping mall in Hoover, Alabama on Thanksgiving night, police rushed to the scene to stop an active shooter. Shortly after their arrival, an officer shot and killed 21-year-old Amantic Fitzgerald Bradford Jr. Autopsy results show that Bradford died after being shot in the head and in the back. Police had initially identified Bradford as the shooter, but later changed their story. While authorities haven't released surveillance or body camera footage from the incident, witnesses at the scene and the Hoover police are saying that Bradford was actually using his gun to try and help out. Amantic Bradford was a young black man with a licensed gun in an open carry state. His death follows a similar incident earlier this month when Jamel Roberson, a black armed security guard at a Chicago bar, was killed by police after he detained a gunman.
My biggest nightmare is that as a legal gun owner that happens to be black, in the case that I have to use my firearm for the self-defense or defense of others, and the police arrive, would I be the one that they thought was the threat and shoot me?
That's Ainsley Reynolds. He's a New Jersey gun owner and life member of the National Rifle Association. According to a 2017 Pew survey, 3 in 10 Americans report personally owning a gun. But there's a big discrepancy when it comes to race. That same survey found that 36% of white people say they're gun owners, higher than average, while 24% of black people say they are gun owners.
If I don't get shot by my fellow folks in blue, I still got to go through court as somebody known as the black man with a gun.
Reverend Ken Blanchard is the founder of the Maryland 10th Cavalry Gun Club and author of Black Man with a Gun Reloaded.
I sat down with both of these gentlemen to talk about the challenges of being a black man with a gun in America. We began by talking about the organization that claims to represent 6 million gun owners across the country, the NRA.
I'm a life member. So when I joined, I became a life member, so I'm in. In order to remain in the private gun club that I belong to, you have to be an NRA member. But however, over the years, even though I fight for gun rights and I know that's what they do, it pains me the fact that I'm not seeing my interests being fought up front by the NRA. Starting with Philando Castillo, every time that I see one of these incidents, and they just don't seem to see it the way that I do, at the minimum, if you put out that statement, a good guy with a gun, and it is determined in the last three incidents that this happened that they were good guys with a gun, and you remain absolutely silent, that silence says a lot to me. The rules seem to apply to others and not me, and they just remain silent, and they just don't understand how it's viewed by black gun owners. And I don't know if maybe they don't care or they just don't get it, but I'm telling you, I've been a member since 2003, it pisses me off. So I'm an NRA member, but me and the NRA are not getting along right now. That's for sure.
Ken, what about you? Do you feel that the NRA is really representing the interests of black gun owners?
Being a life member of the NRA, having drank and slept and supped with these guys, they're saying the same thing they've always said, but the reality is that we don't actually look at color as we should. Everybody skirts around it. We want to pretend like we are fair and not afraid of people, but we still have our issues. And the good guy with a gun is real. The reality of it is that we didn't get the memo that a good guy with a gun can be black. It's still risky being a black man with a gun in 2018.
That's for sure.
What are some of the risks? I mean, Ainsley, you said you worry about similar situations happening to you where you're trying to help people and, in fact, you are seen as the perpetrator and potentially shot yourself. Are there other concerns that you have, both of you?
Oh, yeah. Being black is a threat. We still buy our homes and shop in places where people of color don't live. We still have those issues. We still lock our doors and lock our cars when somebody walks by of color. That fear is still there. So if you amplify that to somebody who has a badge, that's what we got working with us. Fear still kills. False expectations appearing real. We assume that black guy that's 6'5" is a threat when he might be a florist that can't fight in a wet paper bag. But our perception is that dude is a monster.
I would absolutely 100, matter of fact, 1,000% agree with that, except as a 6'3", 350 CPA that has no criminal record. Because think about it. As a black gun owner, we're a law-abiding citizen, or we wouldn't own a firearm. And just like Ken said, is that the locking of doors, you know, I got over it. When I was young, it used to really piss me off. But yeah, there's still the clutching of the purse. Even on my way up here on the subway, I haven't taken the subway in years, you know, since I live and work in New Jersey. But you see it. It's that perception. And part of the issue is just, to me, it's the propaganda. It's out there. Is that every image that you see in movies, on the news, is you're portraying or perpetrating the fact that black men with firearms, bad. It has not changed. So now when you have the good guy with a gun that happens to be black, in, like Ken said, in particular areas where we may not live, or my main concern, I say in my own house. I actually asked the police officer last time I got a firearm, is that how do I differentiate myself from the perpetrator? Because here's the reality. If you live in a black neighborhood, you're more than likely going to be assaulted by someone that looks like you. So if someone broke into my house, and I use the scenario, someone broke into my house, I got my firearm and was able to detain them. Maybe not, even if I didn't shoot them, I detained them. I got the gun on, trained on them. The cops arrive, 6'3", 350, bald-headed black man. How does he know? How does he know upon arriving who is the good guy? Because black guy with a gun, bad. It's out there.
I want to turn to you for a second, Ken, because I met you at the NRA convention in Indianapolis a couple years ago. What about how you're both treated by your fellow gun owners who are not black?
Really well. That's why I've lived in this space for so long, because I had my own issues and stereotypes and prejudices when I first started. And I thought, all right, these rednecks ain't gonna like me. I don't talk like they do. And then the next thing I knew, I realized that I do, speak the same language. And I had to work on myself. But it's outside of that where all my trouble is.
What about you, Ainsley?
I will concur to a point. I would say that without a doubt, where I normally congregate with fellow 2A, they welcome me with open arms, no doubt about it. However, what I started to notice in the age of social media, some will speak to your face in one way, but behind the scenes on social media, I almost think some of them forget that they're Facebook friends with me. And you see some of the posts and some of the forums and things that they say that clearly they have a deep-rooted different view of Black people. And that's a fact. Because I would say in the past 2 years, it's gotten worse. Where these are people that you've actually shot with, shared firearms with, gone to the range with, protests and gone to rallies with. And, you know, they use the word, you know, fellow patriot. But that social media is, I call it, it's the lie detector. It's the truth teller. Because you start seeing some of these posts and you're like, wow, you don't really like Black people.
I want to also bring in this idea about gun culture among Black Americans, right? And what that's been like. I'm wondering, has it changed? We're now in 2018. How do you see Black gun ownership having evolved in the past couple of years, Ken?
After social media, there is a bunch of folks out there with YouTube channels and Instagram accounts, and I see their posts every day. There are a lot of young African, Hispanic, Native American, all nationalities in the Second Amendment fighting now that didn't exist 20 years ago.
Without a doubt. It used to be, especially in the Northeast, the hidden underground, like you're afraid to talk about it. And you're happy when you find out that another person of color actually owns firearms and is good with firearms. Now I can freely kind of talk about it, you know, amongst my friends, because now I found a lot of people that were around me have always been gun owners. They were just quiet about it.
And you had to be.
Yes. You had to be because
there were laws against it. We got relatives that will remind you real quick that, hey, boy, you can't do that. You're like, why? This is like 1990. This is 2000. What are you saying? Well, back in the day, they could actually arrest you for having a musket ball, or those laws don't apply to Black people. I mean, I've heard it all over my tenure. So we've gone from undercover brothers to we're out and proud of it. The organizations around us still haven't caught up.
Also want to bring up the issue of gun violence, right, which is something that's very much in the conversation. And
I don't like that word.
Well, tell me why you don't like that word.
Because violence is violence. And I've heard over the years, you keep talking about violence. I grew up in New York City. Listen, you know, violence to me is violence. I don't know why people just put gun on it. First of all, if you want to say illegal gun violence for the most part, because that's what I experienced coming up. It did make me afraid of firearms. It made me afraid of criminals. So when people talk about gun control, gun violence, how about you do a study on how we can reduce the crime and deal with the criminals? It's almost like you're afraid to deal with the true fact. I hate the phrase guns don't kill people, people kill people, but it's the truth.
But do you think that we could say that Black Americans are definitely affected by gun violence, to use the phrase that's not your favorite? But at the same time, there is a discrepancy in terms of who owns guns and who's affected by the violence surrounding guns.
Violence has always been around since Cain slew his brother. There's nothing new there. Violence has always happened where you got people really close to each other. It happens more in the city than it does in the rural areas. Violence always happened when people don't have hope, don't have education, are ignorant. Violence always happens when there is drug addiction and a place to sell stuff. We kind of latch on to the fact that it happens in a Black community because it's reported, because it's YouTube, because it's stuck on cell phones real quick. Violence happens in Asian cultures. Violence happens in Hispanic cultures. The good news in all of that is that the African-Americans that I'm seeing, the Latinos that I'm checking out, are actually utilizing their Second Amendment. So there'll be less accidental shootings. There'll be less violence in the homes. Folks will be taking care of each other but it won't be fixed overnight. There's no one shot fix all thing for humanity. I mean, if we took all the firearms away right now, we'd be clubbing each other or stabbing each other in the places where guns are hard to get. Knife woundings and knife issues, stabbings are high. Violence is still there.
Can I just kind of step back? Ken said something that when he described violence has been in our culture forever, and the fact that you see it on, you know, YouTube, that's kind of what I alluded to begin with, is that the violence that occurs in the Black community is just broadcast on the news repeatedly. You would almost think that there's no other criminal than us. The bottom line is that crime is committed against the people that you live around. And truth be told, we still live in kind of a very segregated society, to be honest with you. So you are going to harm the people or rob the people that are around you. When you hear these terms, black on black, as if nobody else shoots each other, it's amazing. And hence, that just leads to, and I use the word propaganda, why, you know, black armed citizens are looked at the way we're looked at, even if we're the good guy with the gun.
Reverend Ken Blanchard is the founder of the Maryland 10th Cavalry Gun Club and author of Black Man with a Gun, Reloaded. And Ainsley Reynolds is a gun owner and NRA member from New Jersey. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We reached out to the NRA for this story, but the organization did not respond to multiple requests for comment. But we have heard from you, our listeners, who are black gun owners.
My name is Shatan Bledsoe from Land O'Lakes, Florida. I brought a gun for home protection and one for hunting. I'm a veteran and comfortable with weapons, and I'm trained to handle them. I do not think there are any risks or challenges to me owning a weapon personally because I stay aware and vigilant when I'm out in the world.
Hi, my name is Barry Wynn. I'm calling from Brighton, Michigan. I have inherited several guns, but I never carried one in public, even though my state is open carry. When I see someone walking into an open space with a gun carrying, I immediately leave because the rules don't apply to me. The Second Amendment does not apply in this country equally.
Hi, this is Eric. I am a black gun owner, I guess. I've got them because I wanted them, and I don't think there's any risks or challenges beyond anyone else of any other skin color I've encountered. Why should race have anything to do with my ability to own and use a firearm? I think that's a ridiculous premise.
Are you a black gun owner? Tell us about your experience on our Facebook page or tweet us at The Takeaway.
Go to OmahaSteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut age-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to OmahaSteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
I think kindness is a way of being.
Most things that are done out of kindness is basically done out of love.
I think it's a behavior, a skill. It's glue. It's essential.
Kindness.
Tonight, an act of kindness at a rental car company in Tulsa goes just viral.
One really big random act of kindness.
Kindness is caring enough about others that we treat them with gentleness, graciousness, and generosity.
New tonight, a police officer's random act of kindness isn't going unnoticed.
Good and generous and sacrificing.
Once you start being kind to people, they feel better and it just spreads.
We expect schools to prepare students by teaching them math and science and reading and writing. But what about teaching them kindness?
I started thinking at the beginning of the school year about the way that we teach character education in our classes.
Justin Parmenter teaches language arts to 7th graders at Waddell Language Academy in Charlotte, North Carolina.
You know, I've been doing this job for a long time, and I've noticed that with every year there seems to be a new approach or a new set of curriculum to try to teach character in our schools. And every year I see students' eyes glaze over and I see just the complete disconnect. and no real changes and no real impact.
But then in October, there was a shooting at a high school in Justin's district. A 16-year-old boy was killed over a personal conflict.
It really brought home, I guess, the sense of urgency that we needed to start doing something to be more intentional about practicing kindness and how we support interpersonal relationships in our schools.
So just a few days later, Justin launched a new activity in his classroom, Undercover Agents of Kindness. Each student randomly drew a name out of a bowl and had 2 weeks to do something nice for that person.
I read some research, and the researchers found that the brain can be trained toward more compassionate behavior through regular practice of kindness towards strangers, towards family, towards even towards people that you've had conflict with, that over time, practicing kindness leads to an increase in activity in the part of the brain associated with empathy and with compassion.
One of our listeners heard about Undercover Agents of Kindness and nominated Justin and his students for our series, America the Kind. So I reached Justin in his classroom, along with two of his seventh graders, Elena Grady, and the student who drew her name, Daylin Brown.
I didn't really like the whole idea. I'm one of those people that likes to stay in their social zone. I don't like to try and, like, I'm not really good at meeting new people. So I was nervous about it, to say the least. I thought it was going to be awkward just walking up to someone and just being like, hey, I got you for, well, I can't say that, but I was going to be like, hey, how are you? Or just talking about random stuff because, yeah.
So the way this works is that, Daylin, you pulled Elena's name, right?
Yes.
And so when that happened, what did you know her at that point, or were you surprised?
I had never spoken to her before.
And so when you got Elena's name, what did you decide to do?
Well, it took me a very long time to actually figure out what I wanted to do. So I tried to spend more time with her to find out what the kind of stuff that she liked. Like favorite animal, like anything that if you got it for them, it would make their day. Something like that, you know?
So then what did you end up doing?
I ended up going and getting her ice cream from the cafeteria.
Elena, tell me a little bit about that. When you saw Daylin with ice cream, what did you think?
Well, when she gave it to me, I wasn't even thinking about the project. I was just kind of like, oh, thank you. And then I was thinking about it. I was like, oh, well, that was very nice of her. But why did I get ice cream? And then she was like, oh, it was for the kindness project. And I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot.
I'm wondering, how old are you, Daylin?
12.
And what about you, Elena?
I am 13.
So when you all see the results of this kindness and you look around, and I know this came out of a very difficult moment, they're mentioning the school shooting in your district. Like when you look at that and you look at people your age, do you think there needs to be more kindness today?
I think there should be, because sometimes people can get so upset over the smallest things and they just get so aggravated and annoyed that they just take it all out on people and they get really mad when they really shouldn't be that mad.
And what about you, Daylin?
I think that we should probably be kinder because it's like what Elena said. If you just doing something, a little thing that's nice for people can mean the world to them. Because I know from a personal standpoint, because I came here last year and I had nobody. I transferred from a completely different school. And I remember the first person who came up to me and just started talking to me. And I still talk to them to this day. And I think that they're one of my best friends. And that's because they just decided. Because that year would have been miserable if I didn't have them with me, because I would never have made friends.
What did you learn, Elena, from the project? Did you learn anything about yourself, about your classmates, about kindness?
Well, I learned that a little bit of kindness can go such a long way. Like just giving them an encouraging note for the day, doing anything can mean the world.
Something might seem small to you, but to the other person, like, it's going to mean a lot to them. Like, you might just do something like buying them ice cream like I did, and it might end up making them have a great day or, like, just be more happy in general because someone tried to be kind to them.
One of the goals that Justin, your teacher, had was to also try and get you guys to talk to different people through this project. Daylin, did it help you sort of branch out a little bit?
Yeah, it did. It kind of helped me realize that the things that hold us back are more mental than they are like an actual problem. For me, I always thought that people would just reject me if I ever started talking to them. But the truth is, if you actually try and branch out, you'd be surprised at how nice people can be.
Elena, what do you think about that? Do you agree?
Yes, ma'am, I do. I mean, it's just, you can, when someone does something kind for you or when you do something kind for a person, it's just like, wow, I can do this so much and I can make so many friends and everybody would be so happy. So, yeah.
Now, we're asking everybody that we talk to about, you know, why is kindness important right now? Why is it important, particularly today, in this moment?
Because in the time period we live in, like, we don't communicate as much face-to-face. And if you're texting someone, you can't really express how you're feeling. So, you know, you will never really know.
I think that what Daylan said was awesome because a lot of people, what they do is everybody has a phone, everybody just texts, and no one really gets to socialize a whole bunch. So when you're texting about how you feel or something, you can't actually tell them what you're feeling because they can take it the wrong way through text. But when you tell them in person, they know how you're feeling. It's completely different. You can't be kind through texts, really.
Do you think that this has changed the way that you, Elena, and you, Daylan, are sort of dealing with your peers? And I think it's really interesting that you're talking about the social media element and texting and the things that we've gotten used to. And we assume that you guys, you know, younger people are doing that all the time. So do you think that this has changed the way you look at communicating with each other and being kind?
Yeah, I mean, despite it being a project, I actually had a lot of fun because I actually got to meet a new person out of it. And, like, I guess it was just, it really made me feel more comfortable around my peers because it made me realize they're not that much different than I am. And I was the one who was separating myself.
Justin, I want to come back to you. This was your idea. What have you learned from the kids or for yourself even?
Well, I guess one of the things that I've learned is that change starts with a really small step. Sometimes the problems that we see in the world around us, like the shooting that happened at Butler or just, you know, the bitter political divisions that we have in our country right now, seem so overwhelming that, you know, we almost get into this mentality of just kind of retreating into the bunker and, you know, assuming that it will just sort itself out. But I think that we can take some small, simple steps in the right direction and that there can be a ripple effect where it can start to lead towards the kind of change and towards the kind of world that we really want to live in.
Well, I want to say these are some of my favorite parts of the show these days. So Justin, Daylan, and Elena, keep spreading the kindness, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Justin Parmenter teaches middle school at Waddell Language Academy in Charlotte, North Carolina. Daylan Brown and Elena Grady are two of his seventh grade students. And thanks to Takeaway listener Jennifer Gossett for bringing us this story. You can listen to all of our stories from this series at thetakeaway.org/AmericaTheKind. That's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.